the need to be still. Some of us with muscles and nerves singing in the full flush of youth, some with quiet confidence, and some perhaps weary, worn with the failures, the years, and the passing of strength. And still others, the men and women determined, filled with the zeal of battle for justice yet to be, and for truth still denied or undiscovered. Each and all of us, whatever we be, must come to the time when we need to be still. There comes a time when we must know the need to go apart and meditate, to seek the meaning of our lives, to reconsider the purposes we have accepted, and to establish peace within ourselves. The world presses on us too insistently. The appetites too imperiously demand of us, and we forget to be real persons in ourselves. May this moment be one of redemption, of renewal of life and faith, and the living of it. May the disciplines of humility and courage be strengthened from this time. May it bring a rediscovery of self and a lifting of the heart with a sense of newness from that discovery, new courage, fresh vigor, and a deeper thoughtfulness for the living of life from this day.
We'll now have our readings, ancient and modern.
Yemaya. Once there was a beautiful woman by the name of Yemaya, who looked into the waters of the ocean. There she saw her own reflection and asked, "Who is that beautiful woman? I thought that I was the prettiest thing that the world had ever seen." And as she looked on that woman, there came a rumbling in her belly, and it grew and it grew and it grew until it exploded and covered the land with lakes, rivers, and streams. Yemaya looked into the water of the river there again. She saw that woman and asked, "Who is that beautiful woman? I thought that I was the prettiest thing that the world had ever seen." And again, her belly grew and it grew and it grew until it exploded and sprinkled the heavens with stars and a full moon. Yemaya looked in the full moon, and again she asked, "Who is that beautiful woman? I thought that I was the prettiest thing that the world had ever seen." And again, her belly grew, and it grew, and it grew until it exploded, and before her stood thousands of beautiful women. Yemaya asked, "Who are you, beautiful women? I thought that I was the prettiest thing that the world had ever seen." The women looked deep into the eyes of Yemaya, and there they saw their own reflections.
From The Dance of the Dissident Daughter by Sue Monk Kidd. I'm walking through a country where there has been fighting and oppression. Plants and crops are dying, and droves of people are walking along the road, leaving. I'm among them, exiting the old country that can no longer sustain life, when suddenly the bishop appears, my old nemesis. He holds stone tablets with the Ten Commandments carved on them and tries to hit me with them, but he's so weak and shriveled with age. He can't manage it. I grab the tablets away, stuff them in a paper bag, and walk on, leaving him behind. I come to a new country where things are growing, then to one particular cottage with flowers making an arbor over the door. Inside, I find the wise old crone propped up on a bed, her lips fire red, her hair long and white as the sheets. "Look in your paper bag," she tells me, all the while smiling as if she's up to something. Peering inside, I notice the tablets are gone, and in their place is a magnificent Russian nesting doll. As I lift the doll out of the bag, the old woman starts to sing an exuberant song about being a woman, about beautiful breasts and beautiful wombs. She holds up a mirror as she sings so I can see her image in it, and I'm struck by the beauty I see there. Then I notice I am also able to see her face blazing through the glass too, giving a dual image of my face nested inside hers.
The mystery religion that developed around the myth of Demeter and Persephone had such a powerful impact on people that the rites were celebrated for more than 2,000 years. Try to grasp the immensity of the fact that the chief divine actors in this drama were a mother and daughter. Persephone decides she must leave her mother and embark on her own spiritual journey. This journey has the antecedent in the spiritual quest of the Sumerian goddess Inanna, who also descended to the underworld. Demeter fears for her daughter, grieves at her absence, but knows that the journey is necessary. Ultimately, Persephone returns to her mother, transformed into an adult by her journey, and they rejoice in a new kind of relationship. In the latter patriarchal version of the myth, Persephone is captured and carried off by force. She does not make her own decision, and Demeter is more angry than aggrieved. The daughter is never allowed to grow into her true self, and her relationship with her mother is strained and arbitrary. As women raised in a patriarchal society, we often have terrible problems with our mother-daughter relationships. As tiny children, both girls and boys in Western cultures must separate from their mothers and go into what has traditionally been perceived as the world of their fathers, even though most mothers have always worked outside the home. Mothers are still our primary caretakers, and in order to separate, we reject them. In addition, psychology and sociology often have blamed mothers for every problem imaginable. Both young men and young women are taught to blame and reject their mothers far more than they do their fathers. But women often have an added reason for resenting their mothers. By accepting society stereotypes of women, some mothers have inadvertently collaborated in the stunting of their daughters' growth. As women, we are all daughters. And only by becoming fully adult can we return to our mothers and establish an adult-to-adult relationship. Part of the reason some women may fail to grow up is that only young women are considered desirable or valued in our society. Older women often try to look young because they know they are not wanted if they are old. This attitude was not part of the ancient goddess religions. These myths and metaphors celebrated not only the maidens and the mother, but also the crone or wise old woman who has much to teach. The waxing, full, and waning moon, so closely related to the menstrual cycle, symbolize the life stages of women. Perhaps these myths, metaphors, and symbols can help us today in our efforts to change society's attitudes. At the very least, we can reclaim them as a significant part of women's religious history.
Reflecting on what I took away from Cakes for the Queen of Heaven, I can't see back to the days that Judy and Tanya spoke of when women were revered and worshipped as goddesses, but I can see evolution at work on our way back out of a patriarchal society, uncovering the deep and perhaps immortal spirit of the goddess. I believe that as a species, we evolve from one generation to the next. This evolution is not always linear. Sometimes it's one step forward, two steps back, or any steps forward and back variation thereof, but certainly what came before has an impact on the present. My grandmother, Gaga as we called her, told me that my great-great-grandmother lived with this superstition. If mothers hugged their single daughters of marrying age, they would be spinsters. Thus, my great-great-grandmother did not hug her daughters at all. My great-grandmother, who single-handedly raised three daughters, carried on the tradition, but not as fervently. Gaga did remember being hugged on occasion. As a grandma, Gaga was lots of fun, and it was clear that she loved her daughter, son-in-law, and children and grandchildren dearly, but she mostly hugged and kissed us hello and goodbye. And so it carries forward, losing its grip little by little, one generation at a time. Try to stop me from hugging my daughter and granddaughters. I dare ya. Then I think of the expression rule of thumb. Does anyone know where it comes from? Anyone? The origin is questionable due to poor record keeping, but belief in the existence of a rule of thumb law, a man could hit his wife with a switch no thicker than his thumb if she needed correction, to excuse spousal abuse, can be traced as far back as 1782 in Great Britain. In our country, we have at least legally evolved from government sanctioning of a man hitting his wife and vice versa. We have yet to ban hitting children as a means of instilling discipline, perhaps a next step in our evolution. And don't get me started on the institution of marriage as a sacred union between a man and a woman. I quote a historical perspective on marriage from the ultimate authority of authorities, Wikipedia. A man's need for assurance as to paternity of his children. He might therefore be willing to pay a bride price or provide for a woman in exchange for exclusive sexual access. Legitimacy is the consequence of this transaction rather than its motivation. Married women work harder, lose sexual freedom, and do not seem to obtain any benefit from marriage. But nubile women are a source of jealousy and strife, so they are given little choice other than to get married. In almost all societies, access to women is institutionalized in some way so as to moderate the intensity of this competition, end quote. Thus, in a patriarchal world, love has little to no place in marriage. But as both the institution and we as a species continue to evolve, love and partnership begin to take center stage, no longer about property and legitimacy of offspring. And we are very young at mastering marriage for the new possibilities that it can bring. I think about the importance of women's relationships with each other and how women being robbed of their power has a negative impact on all of us, but without a doubt has a negative impact on men. When I was involved in the Center for Leadership and Equity and Diversity at Montclair State in the mid-90s, statistics clearly showed that our patriarchal society created more life-threatening circumstances for men. Heart disease, cancer, high blood pressure, diabetes, successful suicide attempts, crime, substance abuse. I think about the numbers of women entering the workforce. Equitable distribution of labor has increased on the work front, not necessarily with equal pay, but on the home front, we have not yet learned to relinquish or share our roles as homemakers and primary caregivers. Many of us have two full-time jobs, one out of the home and one in the home. I see 30-something and 40-something women, mothers in my private practice who are trying harder than ever to be superwomen and wonder what's wrong with them when they don't have boundless energy, aren't perfect mothers, don't feel sexy, aren't fulfilled in their jobs as they continually take on more. President of this, chair of that, housekeeper, chauffeur, chief cook and bottle washer. Oh, and don't get me wrong, we have learned to take time for ourselves. So sandwiched between kids' lessons, homework, meal prep, a 50-hour work week, we do book club, therapy, yoga, women's groups, Zumba, get manis and pedis, massages, etc. If we can't do it all, then we're just not good enough. And do you ever notice how critical and hard we are on each other? It's exhausting. We're not simplifying, we're complicating. We're not working smarter, we're working harder. So then, if the topic of this part of the sermon is honoring our goddesses of the present, then why am I doing my best to represent where we are in the present as abysmally depressing? Well, in the words of another great authority, Dr. Phil, you can't change what you don't acknowledge. Take a moment right now and take a very deep breath in. Let it out slowly and acknowledge the enormity of goddess power. not just for women, but for us all. Reflect on this. Goddess power can't exist without God power. Be good to yourself. And yes, I am going to use the C word, have compassion for yourself. I ask that we and those who know us best not let us get away with the superheroine thing as it usurps us of our power. Make the time and take the time to inquire into how you came to be who you are from an historical perspective. What did those who came before you make possible for you and your daughters, wives, sons, and husbands? How do you live your life that makes something else possible for those who came after you? Make the time and take the time to let yourself go to that sacred place of quiet where the goddess lives. Blessed be, amen, and ah, women.
As the final part of our sermon, I'm going to make this very quick because I realize we're a little over time here. I wanted to share two basic things about my response to the Cakes class. First, one of the very best parts of my class was the reawakening of my own feminist leanings. A lot of you know I'm a very successful lawyer, I've got a great family, and sometimes, you know, it's easy to take it for granted and forget the women, many women whose shoulders we stand on. I saw Gloria Steinem on Friday night on Charlie Rose, and by the way, if you haven't heard, she's going to be in a documentary tomorrow night on HBO. She acknowledged the major gains that have been made. No longer do people argue that it's not natural for women to have a career. On the other hand, we all know that the United States is still behind a lot of countries in supporting women and mothers and our reproductive rights. But what about the future goddesses, our daughters? One of my dear Cake Group friends, Dorothy Summer, who couldn't be here, reminded me about the difficult world that our daughters live in. As the book Reviving Ophelia noted, today's daughters are coming of age in a more dangerous, sexualized, and media-saturated culture than ever before. They face incredible pressures to be beautiful and sophisticated, which means that in junior high and high school, it could include using drugs and chemicals, of course, makeup, very attractive clothes, and being sexual. As they navigate a more dangerous world, girls are often less protected and more vulnerable to the social media and social pressures. Anyone who has a daughter or a niece or a granddaughter or friends of a, you know, daughters of friends has to be worried. A few weeks ago, I was speaking to a young teenager, a teenage girl, who told me she absolutely was not a feminist. And I have to tell you, my first reaction was, what are you talking about? What, you don't want to be paid the same as a man? What, you don't want to have equal rights? What, are you crazy? And I think I actually kind of came down a little hard, and I realized that it wasn't really fair because, you know, she didn't know. She hasn't learned about the work of the women of the past. She had no idea who Gloria Steinem was. So I send out a plea that it's time really to teach our daughters the importance of their own power and of their intelligence, and that self-worth just doesn't come from the clothes you wear, the friends you have, the cool cell phone you have. As we hand down to our daughters our connection over the millennia to women in the spiritual past, I have to remember my own youth spent as a young Catholic girl raised in a Catholic church. And I have to tell you, I was pissed. I mean, I was told I was extremely devout, but I could never be an altar boy, certainly never a priest. And when it finally came time for me to reject my Catholic faith, it was for a lot of reasons, because it's kind of a crazy religion. If you ask me, we can go offline on that one. But I never felt fully accepted by the Catholic Church as a woman. Imagine how liberating it would have been to grow up in a world where God can be a woman. I want to make sure that our daughters have that world today. With that said, I'm not talking about replacing male gods with female goddesses. Actually, my favorite histories of all those slides was hearing about the many times when male gods and female goddesses worked together.
I know I couldn't have achieved my successes without a father who urged me and all my sisters to do the best we can and to have a career. I couldn't have succeeded without an incredibly supportive husband and kids. And I recognize that the rigid structure of an all-powerful and dominating God is poisonous both to men and to women. So one last thank you to my CAKES class and CAKES friends, and also to the UU Montclair and the UUA Unitarian Universalist principles that remind us once again of the inherent worth and dignity of every person and of the importance of justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. May each of you, in your search for spiritual enlightenment, find peace and joy and discover a god or goddesses or both, or a spiritual guide or a vast universe of human connection that will make your life meaningful, complete, and whole. Namaste.
Our closing words this morning come from Starhawk. Starhawk is a writer, human rights and eco advocate, and a self-identified witch. She lives in California. She also was one of the composers of our first musical interlude. And she wrote, "The symbolism of the goddess is not a parallel structure to the symbolism of God the Father. The goddess is in the world, manifest in each of us. She can be known internally by every individual in all her magnificent diversity." Namaste. Our service is over, right? No?
Our worship is over.
Sorry. God, I sit here every Sunday. You'd think I know it. Our worship is over. Let our service begin.